Here on Gadget Lab, we dive deep into the tech universe, tackling questions like, is giving companies access to your genetic material a good idea? And are the latest phone releases really that different than the last ones? We want to help you make informed decisions about what is worth your attention. And here's something that is undeniably worth your time, a digital subscription to Wired. Lucky for you, we are giving Gadget Lab listeners an exclusive discount, 20% off an annual subscription to Wired. Just visit wired.com and use the promo code GL20 to get 20% off a digital subscription. Use GL20 to get exclusive access to stories on the latest innovations like AI, deepfakes, and VR, as well as today's most talked about people in technology.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Mike.
Lauren.
Mike, how frequently would you say you go on Facebook these days?
These days, I would say I go on there about once every 3 days.
And does that include Instagram and WhatsApp and everything else?
Oh, no, I'm on Instagram like every waking hour of every day.
Yeah. So you're on Facebook a lot.
Yikes.
Hey, everyone. Welcome to Gadget Lab. I'm Lauren Good. I'm a senior writer at Wired.
And I'm Michael Calori. I'm a senior editor here at Wired.
So today we're talking about Facebook. Earlier this week, we had a conversation with Facebook's Andrew Bosworth, also known as Boz. Bosworth is a longtime Facebook exec. He's currently vice president of augmented and virtual reality at Facebook's Reality Labs, where they work on futuristic stuff. So we talked about Boz a few episodes ago, and then he decided to come on the show and sort of offer his take on things. So now basically, I'm just going to talk about Tim Cook and Sundar Pichai on this show until I run out of breath, in the hopes that they decide they need to come on Gadget Lab too. But anyway, a few weeks ago, Facebook had just shown off a prototype wrist wearable that is controlled by your thoughts, sort of. It's an electromyography device, which means it picks up electrical nerve signals and translates them into computer commands. Now, if this sounds like something out of dystopian sci-fi, you're not alone. It's a little out there. And there are at least two sides to this to explore. One is that this thing could actually be pretty useful in terms of AR and VR applications, which is what Bosworth and his team are working on. And the other thing to consider is that Facebook's many missteps with user privacy have given people some trust issues. And now Facebook is asking you to let it read your body signals. So that's what we talked to Andrew Bosworth about this week. It was a pretty lively conversation. We talked about Facebook's hardware ambitions, privacy, trust, and whether or not all of these connected technologies, especially the ones that are now infused with AI and machine learning, can really be considered just tools, which I think is how he looks at some of them. Mike, what would you say was your favorite part of this conversation?
I think my favorite part was the conversation around privacy, because this is sort of uncharted territory for companies that have to deal with user data. So I thought that was really interesting.
All right, well, let's get to the interview. Andrew Bosworth, also known as Boz, thank you so much for joining us on Gadget Lab.
Thank you for having me. I'm thrilled to be here.
My first question for you is, are you wearing the wearable?
I am not currently wearing the wearable. I'm a little more careful with things like this. Keep in mind, we've talked about this. You guys have seen some of the demos in public of what they look like. Right now, they're not really consumer ready. While the technology for doing EMG and having these neural interfaces is in the prototype phase, you can play with it, you can use it. They're not really consumer form factors yet. That is obviously something that we're working on today. You've seen those demos, they're a little clunky. And the path to miniaturizing those is there, but it's still a matter of active development.
Are you wearing anything on your wrist? I'm trying to see through the Zoom right now.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, no.
No, you've got an... Okay, that's an Apple Watch.
I have an Apple Watch.
Okay.
Which I enjoy. I use it 99% of the time to log into my laptop or to find my phone. Those are the top one and two use cases. A distance third is checking the time. And actually, that's the only three things I do.
Yeah, it's kind of remarkable how at the time that it launched back in 2015, there was a lot of conversation about whether or not Apple Watch was going to become another platform for third-party apps. And it does seem like the core use cases, you know, anecdotally, are the ones that are just totally native to this wearable and like the things that are just built into it, right? That make life a little easier.
And it's such a tight environment. And I do think that's one thing that we've got spoiled at as consumers. The web is this wonderfully expansive thing where technology you buy just suddenly gets better and better and better and has access to more and more experiences overnight. And when you're dealing with these really tight thermal environments like the wrist, like glasses, it's just really constrained. And that space is hard for third-party developers to make use of if they even have the tools to do so. And that's going to be the story for a lot of these new technologies, is they're going to come up with some, you know, certainly good second and third-party integrations, but a lot of the value has to also be delivered first-party.
Just for the benefit of listeners who may not be familiar, I'd like you to just walk us through what the wearable that you showed off last month is. And you mentioned EMG technology. If you could just take us through that, I think it would be helpful.
Yeah, I mean, EMG is not a new technology, right? It's a technology we've all seen and probably experienced before, where, you know, electrical signals are observed through the skin with the placement of usually a small sticker attached to a wire. And it's great for a lot of different purposes in a medical setting. What we've determined is that actually you can also detect neural impulses that are going to the hands and activating the hands. And you can actually detect them at a level so minute that your hands don't even have to visibly move for us to detect that you've sent a signal to your hand. And with that kind of tool, if you had a really high resolution version of that on your wrist, you could do something, for example, like send a text message without having to move your hand at all. So while it's still your brain forming an intention and sending it down your musculature, which is how keyboards work and how mice work, it's doing all of that without the actual movement, which is quite cool, especially if you imagine walking around the world with augmented reality glasses. You're not going to have a keyboard with you. You're not going to have a mouse. You can do things with your hands, but that's going to look a little bit unwieldy. Plus, arms do, in fact, get tired. And so the ideal way that you want to have access to kind of silent interaction and communication even is through a neural interface, something that allows you to use your thoughts to power the device itself very directly. And so it's kind of science fiction that's become a near reality, thanks to tremendous research, in particular in our group by Thomas Reardon and his team at Control Labs.
So this is just one of many concepts that you and your team are working on in Facebook's reality labs, as you call them, which was really born of this series of acquisitions of other hardware companies like Control Labs. And I think the most notable one, of course, is Oculus. But I think when most people think about Facebook, right, they're using your apps, they're using your software. And like to quote Marc Andreessen, software is eating the world. So tell us how you're thinking about hardware these days. Like, why is Facebook so focused on making hardware?
Yeah, well, first, I want to kind of invert your premise. The acquisitions were born of, in fact, this deeper desire that Facebook has to help people connect better. There's an old saying attributed to Alan Kay, a famous computer scientist, that people who are serious about software build their own hardware. And we were in a sweet 20-year period there in the industry where that wasn't true. Software was really pretty separate from hardware, with the exception really being Apple. But what we're finding is that as mobile phones reach the top of their maturity curve, there's just not a lot more that they're going to do, which means if you want to do more than a mobile phone is capable of, you have to move beyond it. You have to do something different. And it's not just Facebook. It's the entire industry moving in this direction where people realize, hey, to achieve the goals I want with my software, which in our case is to connect people, I have to go beyond the platforms that are available because they simply aren't going to do it for me. And so I do think that it's really important. The causality here is that was the fundamental desire. And quite a bit of our work didn't spin up out of acquisitions. The vast majority of our research was first party. The vast majority, Portal was first party. The vast majority of our work really came from Facebook itself trying to manifest some concept of connection into the world. And so that's what leads you on this path to do this work.
But does that mean that a company like Apple, that fundamentally started in hardware and likes to tout its, you know, its full stack advantage, which means it just, it makes all the parts, or designs at least, all of the parts that go into the product from hardware to software, are they just always going to have the advantage? Is it possible for a quote unquote software company like Facebook to catch up?
Yeah, I don't think it's super static. The industry is one that at any given moment appears, you know, that we all know the direction it's going to go. But I think we could all go back one decade and we would not have predicted the world that we live in today. The same is true of two decades and three decades. The pace of technological change is kind of unyielding, and that creates opportunities and it creates risks. I think for companies in Apple's standing, again, the company I like, you know, I've got their product on my wrist, I've got another one in my pocket. Yeah, they've got really successful product lines. They're going to want to attach things to that. They're going to want to make the iPhone more useful, and you should expect that. And that's a huge advantage that they have. It's also a potential liability if someone sees a world that potentially makes the iPhone obsolete. What does that mean? And can any company confront the innovator's dilemma to really disrupt their own successful business to keep it going? It's a challenge that we all face, and few companies kind of thrive through that. So I think for me, it's a very competitive marketplace. Apple is certainly one of the best, is probably the best in the world right now at it. And that's great. You know, I'm an enthusiast. I want this technology, and I'll be happy when it exists in the world. But I'm going to give them a run for their money. And I think we've got some advantages as well. And in particular, we also care about different things. Facebook really wants to connect people. And this is a debate that goes back to the very earliest eras of computing, you know, 50s and 60s. Quite a few people see the computer as a tool to extend the individual, to make the individual more powerful, smarter, more productive. And they are that. But they're also a tool to connect people. I love the mother of all demos. We talk about it all the time. Doug Engelbart, 1968, doing a video call with live document editing, co-editing across distance. That was a profound statement at the time of where he believed the technology had to play. He believed it lived in a collaborative space. And that's what we represent, I think. You know, I think there's a lot of great technology companies out there focused on the first bucket, on making you more powerful as an individual, making you smarter, being able to get information, have access to tools. That is awesome. I love it. I use all of it. I also like the other side, though. I also like to talk to people, communicate with people. And if you made me choose, I would pick the latter. And that's a different point of view. And we just benefit when there's a competitive market with people with different points of view kind of bringing their products into the marketplace.
But then Apple would probably say, if Facebook's goal or philosophy is to connect people, Apple would probably retort that their goal is privacy, and that Facebook doesn't necessarily have the best track record for that. And let's just pretend here we've sought comment from Apple and that is what they have said. What would your response be to that?
Look, I mean, I think there's two different things here. One of which is maybe the most fundamental difference in our philosophy is actually the business model. Facebook wants to give as much away to people as possible. Apple wants to make as much money off of each person as they can. Our business model, I see, is extremely aligned with what consumers want to do, which is to keep more of their money for themselves and have access to great tools and services. I believe in that every day and twice on Sunday. I worked on Facebook's ads business for a long time. Nobody works harder to keep your data private, because that is the competitive advantage that Facebook has in the ads marketplace than Facebook does. And I think there's a little bit of a question of, okay, moving beyond business model, there's a second piece, which is that, like I said before, Facebook wants to connect you with the people around you, and Apple wants that to be a tool that you use primarily for yourself. And that's valuable for the market to have that degree of differentiation. The only challenge is that over the last several years, there's kind of a dearth of real explorations of what mobile phones could be. They've really settled in to kind of a rut. I mean, the last 6 or 7 years. I mean, the phone that you have in your pocket right now is pretty similar to the one that you had in your pocket 5 or 6 years ago. There's not a lot of innovation in that space. There's not a lot of new things that you're able to do in that space. And that's okay. That's what happens to all technologies. They ride this S-curve up. So I think one part of it is Apple and Facebook have very different business models. And no surprise, I have a lot of confidence that ours is the business model that is the most friendly to consumers. But at the same time, we also have different fundamental visions of technology. And I don't think either one is right or wrong. And I think they have a relationship to each other that is ideally symbiotic. But it takes time to get there. You don't just show up and be like, hey, Apple, do it our way. Or they don't show up and say, hey, do it our way. It's a conversation. And when one side of that conversation gets too powerful, you can see what happens. You know, I think when one side of the conversation starts to dictate to everyone else how their software needs to behave, that can be uncomfortable for those of us who see ourselves as providing valuable services and innovating.
All right, we're going to take a quick break, and then when we come back, we'll have more with Boz.
Hey everybody, it's Neil. I've got some huge news. Decoder is moving to Mondays and Thursdays. We're adding a second episode of the show. On Mondays, we'll have our classic interviews with CEOs and other troublemakers.
I think we're going to have to start having conversations about how do we pay those jobs that can't be done by AI.
And on Thursdays, we'll be explaining big topics in the news with Verge reporters, experts, and other friends of the show.
There's a new generation of people on the internet. Google search has always sucked for them. So, you know, there's no reason for them to be loyal. They can just go to TikTok.
This is going to be really fun. I'm very excited about all this. So go subscribe wherever you get your podcasts now.
So one of the things that comes up a lot whenever we're talking about user privacy and particularly the hardware that you guys are working on at Facebook Reality Labs is that a lot of the computer intelligence functions for the products happen on the device. I would like you to just tell us what that means.
Yeah, this is super important to me. And, you know, to the conversation, I didn't even get into the question, forgive me earlier, Lauren, about privacy, which is such an important one. Privacy is one of these expectations that is wonderfully well aligned with the limitations I described earlier about the capacity of these devices. When we can avoid activating the wireless transmitter, we always want to, because it's really expensive in terms of power and thermals to operate that thing. So we want to do as much computation locally as possible. We want to keep as much data locally as possible. And then as the use case, as what the consumer wants to accomplish becomes too complex to be done in the thermal or compute space of that device, we have to explain to the consumer, okay, here's the data we collected. Actually, before that, the consumer should already know what data is on the device to begin with. Then here's data that we've got to process on a server. And you know, here's the terms of that. Here's the reason for it. It's justified. And here's the explanation. And they've got to have control over that data so they can know it's there, they can delete it, they can take care of it. And then there's even a third layer of like, hey, here's some optional functionality that if you wanted to do is a good thing, but you don't have to do. And what falls into these buckets of being kind of core functionality versus, you know, optional opt-in functionality, what can be done locally on device? It's a technical question to some degree. And I think here's where Facebook has some superpowers. I think we're the best in the world at taking machine learned models and miniaturizing them down to run locally on device. And that's just from a long time of running on, you know, lower end feature phones, even that, you know, of the kind that very few other companies could support. We've been able to bring some of our models down to those levels. And we were pioneers here. You know, we were doing, you know, portal handling, the wake word kind of conversations on device as much as possible. All the smart camera work for Portal is on device and has been. So I think for me, like, this is hugely important to us. Whenever we can do it on device, we want to do it on device. There are some things for which you need to go to the server, at which point you need to make sure that the consumer is in control and understands.
So describe, you know, that then. What does that actually look like when you say the consumer is in control and understands? Because
yeah,
my thought is maybe, and we're seeing this from other products as well, for example, the new Google Home Nest Hub, I can't keep track of their naming, but they're doing some of these functions on device. Like, for example, their sleep tracking, which uses this kind of miniaturized radar solution that they've developed in their labs. But then ultimately, it's still suggesting that you share that health data, your sleep data, to Google Fit, right, which is this cloud-based application. So it is, there is an encouragement for the user to share things. And then after that, it's kind of like this giant, you know, I say like it's a shrug emoji. What happens to it after that? So ultimately, like if someone is using a Facebook portal, a Facebook, let's say our glasses that may eventually come out, if there are some functions that are happening on device, but ultimately there's still data that's being sent to the server, how do you actually give a consumer control over what happens after that?
Well, it's actually quite straightforward. The execution of it is not, but the doing of it is straightforward. Like on Facebook, you can see, you have access to all the data that Facebook has on you, and you can individually or collectively remove it. And, you know, we take that incredibly seriously. That's obviously a matter of policy, global policy at this point. So from a data control standpoint, it's straightforward. Likewise, from a sharing standpoint, that's always been straightforward. It's like, who am I sharing it with? What's the audience? So those two, I think, are pretty well-established types of controls that people have on the internet and on their devices. More generally, though, I mean, look, it's a question of, does the consumer want to exchange the value? Look, this goes back to, Microsoft early 2000s, right? Like you install the software, it says, hey, can I share crashes and analytic reports with the server to improve the software? And a lot of people check on that box because they're not worried about it. They feel, yep, I understand, you know, I understand what this is for, how it's going to be used, what the data consists of, and I'm comfortable with it. And it hasn't really been a problem for, I don't know, 20 some odd years that people have been doing it. That's really commonplace. Or if you want, go get a portal out of the box. If you don't have one, you should. So you can go ahead and I'll wait. No, I'm just kidding. You get a portal out of the box, part of the flow. It says, hey, when you use our assistant, when you use the wake word, it's a really explicit thing. It says that has to go to the server because that's where we keep the answers. That's how we understand the question. And not only that, it might be reviewed either by an AI system or even by an employee of the company. It's right there written, and you say, yeah, I accept it, or nope, I don't accept that. That's in the kind of what we'd call the forced choice framework is the kind of user design language that you use to describe that. So everyone who goes through a portal and sets one up goes through that decision. So I think it's very clear about what it is, why it is, how it's used, and they have a choice to use it or not use it. Listen, if I could provide the assistant without going to the server, I'd love to. We don't have the technology. We don't have the capability to do that locally on device. We can't keep the entirety of the world's knowledge on the device. So alas, it's got to go to the server. And by the way, we want to keep improving this thing, so it could be ended up being heard by a contractor. So if you're not comfortable with that, then don't use this feature. Same with Google Fitness. If you don't think the Google Fit Cloud thing is useful to you, definitely don't do it. If you don't think it's worth the risk to your data, definitely don't do it. You don't have to do it. So for me, it's like, the point is letting consumers control the experience that they want to have. I do think sometimes we infantilize consumers. Like these are, you know, broadly speaking, intelligent people who have gone out and have made money and decided to exchange that money for a good or a service. They want to use that. They want to get value in their life for it. They get to decide how they do it. So I think, you know, from a high level perspective, the mechanism isn't hard. Actually executing is really the key piece. And that's where I really do feel very fortunate that we're part of Facebook, because Facebook has already built, frankly, the world-class infrastructure around this kind of stuff. And so we get to benefit not just from the expertise that the company has, but also from the actual infrastructure of it.
What you're fundamentally talking about is that people are pretty comfortable trading private information, whether it's anonymized or not, for features, right? Like in order to get a feature, you have to, you know, offer a little bit to the company that's offering it. It reminds me a little bit of when we were in college and we went to the bar and there was that person handing out free packs of cigarettes if you just gave them your driver's license so they could scan it, right? And we all did that. And I think, you know, that's pretty indicative of like sort of the early stages of this type of exchange. Now, I think, you know, as you say, consumers are pretty well versed in how this works, and they're going to continue doing this. They're going to continue offering up private information for features. Sooner or later, there could be a tipping point, right? There could be a point where consumers aren't willing to give any information at all. And then at that point, is the product still useful to them?
Yeah, and most of these products that we're talking about are. You know, I think Portal's a good example of one where it's like, hey, you know, it's a great product. Shoot, you know, right, I have it on my desk right now. It's showing me a picture of my daughter when she was young. And that's great, you know, digital picture frame. Now, it's not priced correctly for a digital picture frame, though it is quite affordably priced. Again, go out and get one anytime you get a chance to. So, you know, that's a feature that doesn't need anything. Now, I happen to have imported those photos from Facebook, but I needn't have had to. I could have easily just done so from my phone. But the truth is, like, we don't feel like that's the product. The product that we want to provide is one where it's video calling. We require a Facebook account because we would say, hey, get this product for video calling. If you don't want a video call, no problem. Keep your money. Save your money and do something else with it and don't get this product. So there are, like, really three layers to this. Like, what is the core feature set? Like, what is the core bundle without which there is no product? And it's a bad value for someone to exchange their hard-earned money for that good. Okay. Then there's, like, yeah, the features that are on the periphery of this. I think this device is better with the assistant. But if you don't want to use the assistant, it's still great. If all you want to do is video calling and you don't want the assistant, or you've got another assistant in the room already because someone gave you one, that's great. No problem. You don't have to do that. So that's an extension. I think it's still a valuable product even without that. So people can choose. And then there might be things even further a thing, like, you know, hey, let's do an Instagram integration. And so WhatsApp, you can use WhatsApp on your portal device, but you don't have to. And so if you don't use WhatsApp, as some people, especially in North America, aren't big WhatsApp users, no problem. That's a thing that might as well not be there. It doesn't affect your value proposition. If you are in the UK, well, that's a huge deal. You really want to get that WhatsApp support. And so, I don't know, for me, it's actually not that hard, such as it always has been with consumers and products. Like, they're going to decide, they're going to get educated, and they're going to decide what is a good exchange, not just for money, but overall value. You know, it's like, hey, I'm going to get a car. This car might kill you. So let's assess the risk of death here. This car takes a bunch of space in my driveway. It's not all monetary concerns. You know, when engaging in commerce, people, and I'm not under some myth that everyone's the completely rational actor, but I think in general, you have to trust people to make their own decisions and be responsible for their own decisions. And so when they buy these things, they think about what's the total picture of this package, and is that something I want to engage in? And by the way, I think to your point earlier, the answer is, like, by and large, yes, people love Facebook. Billions of people love Facebook and are using it all the time. People are really loving our VR headsets. They're really loving Portal. We are selling a lot of them. Like, they love them. And I think they're well-informed. And it's our job to make sure that they're well-informed. And we do that on the packaging. We do that in the press. We do that in how we announce it. We do that in the product itself. But it is their decision how they want to engage with it. And I do trust them. I guess fundamentally, that's one thing that I think has been a gap between technologists and sometimes the press that covers technology, is, like, I do trust individuals to make decisions locally. There are bad cases, there are cases, and we haven't done enough to prevent those, and we're aware of that now, and that's a thing that we prioritize. But for the average case, I do think there is a good understanding. We've never had a better discussion globally about privacy than we've had the last several years.
There's so much to unpack there. I mean, what I hear you describe technology and some of the things that you yourself are finding valuable in technology, I hear you describe it kind of as a tool, right? Which is, I think, how some of these products were originally designed to be tools, when not everything was internet connected and wirelessly sharing data or sharing data through social media. I think that's an optimistic view, though, of technology, in the sense that it kind of positions it as being value neutral. And do you believe that the technology products we're using today, specifically the very connected products, are or can be value neutral still? Isn't it fair to say that some are probably better at large for society than others?
No. So for me, you know, no one, I certainly didn't mean to imply that technology is neutral. I don't think I've ever said that, and I don't believe it. As soon as humankind invented the hammer, I'm sure somebody murdered somebody with a hammer. And such is the nature of leverage. And I'm always reminded of kind of the first engineering book I ever had as a child was The Inclined Plane. The Way Things Work, and the feature is The Inclined Plane, and it talks about how the first thing that humans did with The Inclined Plane was roll a boulder up and drop it on a mammoth. Like, I don't think that's really historically accurate, by the way, but that was, like, the first thing they did. It was like, ah, good, we found a hill that's, like, we can allows us to push this heavy boulder. We couldn't lift it straight up, but we could push it up this hill and drop it on that mammoth. So technology isn't neutral. I'm not saying that it is neutral. But as a consequence, it does require, I think, a degree of trust in humanity and humankind that is, you know, understandably fleeting at times, especially in modern times. But you kind of have to believe that, like, the when you give people these tools, you're giving them the power. That is an equalizing force, potentially. Again, not a neutral force, but an equalizing force, especially the types of tools around information. You know, I think we would all be very wary if I suggested that we actively limit the information available to poor people. But make no mistake, that's what internet policy in the United States has done for the last 20 years. It's really a shame then. And I think most people would agree with that. And yet, when we propose then to connect people, there's a lot of hand-wringing about it. And so as with any technological advancement, once you have the hammer, you need to have, okay, we need to have some rules about that hammer and how we're going to use it and how we're not going to use it. And there has to be consequences for the people who use the hammer the way we didn't intend the hammer to be used.
But isn't there also technology itself? And I understand what you're saying at the policy level, but isn't there also a way in which technology itself could be nudging people into behavior that normally they would not necessarily participate in, or it could be exploitative, right? There could be a fundamental sort of dynamic that exists, but the technology ends up exploiting that. I mean, there are also, I think, controls at the tech level as well as the policy level that affect the way we're interacting with it.
Well, let's talk about two things. I mean, first of all, you know, again, you can't surprise people. So, you know, none of the things that are happening should be invisible necessarily. I think people should have as much visibility as they can into how these systems work. And so if you think about the conversation we just had around privacy, or even the conversation we had about before that around data and access, like the actual number one principle, which has a number next to it and a name that everyone on my team will know, is never surprise people. So that's number one. Once you've cleared that hurdle and you said, okay, people are informed, like they are aware of what this thing is, I do think people make decisions. I mean, I'll ask you, Lauren, the direct question, like, do you feel like, you've lost agency in your life as a consequence of the tools that you have? And yeah, it's a fair question. I think people can answer it differently. I'm curious how your answer is.
Well, I don't know if you happened to read the story I published in Wired just a short while ago.
What a punch. I just missed it. I'm sure it's in the queue. I just haven't gotten to it just today.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's basically about my experience as a technology journalist over the past decade or more of using all of these various applications, partly because of my job, partly because I was compelled by them for some reason, but a lot of it because of my job and feeling a little bit alarmed at how massive my digital footprint had become, and then not realizing how out of control my internet experience felt until I went through kind of this traumatic life experience and felt as though I just didn't have control over my feeds, the advertising I was seeing, my photo memories, my Facebook on this day notifications, and feeling like it took a lot of labor to go through and sort of try to clean that up. And so, yeah, I mean, and I'm probably an extreme case. Mike and I have talked about this on the Gadget Lab podcast previously. Because of our jobs, we have to test a lot of things and experiment with a lot of software. So not everyone will fall into that edge case.
Yeah.
But yeah, I feel like it gives me some agency when I am able to use technology as a tool. But yeah, then I feel a remarkable lack of agency when, let's just say, the algorithms start making decisions for us.
Yeah, so sorry, I thought you might have been referring to a different piece. I did read that piece.
Okay.
And it was an important piece and obviously made important and I think valuable rounds internally for us. I mean, I think you're right. It's not, I don't think it's as quite as narrow as you've cast it. It's not the commonplace experience, but it's not as narrow. And I've long believed that these systems should have much more semantic control, because that's just how we as humans understand things. Part of the challenge here is, of course, semantic understanding is a challenge of artificial intelligence that is mostly still ahead of us. Whereas, you know, very basic things around syntax and clustering are kind of pretty mature, and there's an unevenness there, though I do think that'll even out over time. I do think there are very reasonable solutions to the problem that you faced going forward. And I think this might be really the technological response, which is like, oh, okay, someone has used the hammer in a way I didn't intend, or the hammer made me feel bad. Let's put some boundaries on the hammer. Let's build a better hammer. And that is the pace, the evolution. The answer isn't like, throw all the hammers into the sea. Like, that's a bad solution. Like, there's a better solution,
which
is like,
yeah,
let's make the hammers better. It's like, oh, you know what we can do? We can take nails out with the hammer. Like, the first hammers didn't have that. Now, you know, you use a hammer, you take a nail out and you put it in. It's pretty cool. At some point, that wasn't the case. It only put them in. How annoying is that? I put the nail in the wrong place. How do I get it out? So I think my point is, like, I think you were pointing out very real shortcomings, and it was a, by the way, it was a touching piece of work and personal, and it,
thank you.
I think it was important for people to read, so thank you for doing that. And my solution to that isn't like throw the hammer into the ocean. It's like, ah, we got to put a nail puller on this thing. We are putting nails in places that we didn't intend to put nails. And that's not creating the experience we want to create for people. So when it comes to, you know, agency, though, I think fundamentally, it's like we can change jobs. We can get off platforms. We can put phones down. Like, it's actually not the end of the world. You know, I think people are sometimes surprised. Like, when I go on vacation, I actually like kind of unplug a lot more, and I do different things. I use my phone still, but I use it for different things. And so I do feel like we have control over ourselves as individuals. I mean, at some point, I guess these always end up as conversations of free will, which I'm not sure how productive are going to be after thousands of years of mankind's debate on the topic. But for me, the more practical thing, when you get to the nuts and bolts of it, it's like, oh, cool, that tool sucks for you, or that tool isn't working for you, or it's broken, and we should fix it. And I like that there's a lot of urgency to fix it. I like that people are holding us to a high bar and saying, hey, you've got a great opportunity, but you're screwing it up for me. And I'm not getting the value that other people are getting out of this thing, and you should be better. Yeah, I agree. You're going to find no argument that for me that we should be better. I'm dedicating my life to making these things better. That is what I do for a living.
You were almost on your way out the door. You were almost on your way to sabbatical, and you got pulled back in.
That's
to
right.
Make these products better.
The legend. It's a true story. It's what we had our bags packed. I wasn't gonna be home for 6 solid months. I wasn't gonna be at my house for 6 months, and I 3 days out. I got, or maybe it was 2 days out. I got pulled back in.
Well, you know, if you like Lauren's story that she wrote for Wired, then you'll absolutely love the review that I wrote about the coffee maker. So I'll be sure to send you that link.
Yes, please do. I'm sure it's equally touching and personal for you,
it is.
Michael.
I got emotional.
Let's take another very quick break, and then we'll be right back.
Hackers and cybercriminals have always held this kind of special fascination.
Obviously, I can't tell you too much about what I do.
It's a game. Who's the best hacker? And I was like, well, this is child's play.
I'm Dina Temple-Raston. And on the Click Here podcast, you'll meet them and the people trying to stop them.
We're not afraid of the attack. We're afraid of the creativity and the intelligence of the human being behind it.
Click Here. Stories about the people making and breaking our digital world.
AI machine.
Satellite. Engine ignition.
Click here.
And liftoff.
Click here every Tuesday and Friday, wherever you get your podcasts.
So on the day that we're taping this, Facebook also announced a new suite of audio-focused products. And I would like to know how you see that tying into the ambitions that you have with the Reality Labs. And what I really want to know is this sudden interest among users and at Facebook in audio an existential threat to the future of VR?
Oh, I think VR dovetails really nicely with the lessons that we are learning about audio. This actually starts earlier than people realize. I don't know if you guys know this or not. There's a pandemic. It's a global pandemic. People are spending a lot of time on video calls like us right now. And what's been interesting is I talk to Mark all the time as part of my job, and also socially, but mostly as part of my job. And he's prefers
Are you guys like in a pod? Like, do you hang out in each other's backyards during the pandemic? Okay.
There are pods about. No, sadly, no. We're doing our own thing, my family. But yeah, but so we talk often. And more as the pandemic raged on, it was audio called. We'd be doing on audio. And what a lot of us found, I think, was that video is a little bit exhausting. And there's a lot of psychological research and a lot of articles about this. Some of it's you're looking at yourself, some and you can't stop because, you know, that's just the nature of the beast. Some of it is you're just worried about anxiety about what's in your background and your voice and your appearance, and you have to put your face on, and I had to trim my beard for this and powder my brow because it's extremely shiny. I really did. I mean, you're laughing, but you don't believe me, but I really do that before I do video calls. I'm a man of little hair on top of my head, for those who are just on the audio-only version of this podcast, which I imagine is all of it. So anyways, so people are doing audio as a way of reducing the pressure on themselves. And I think, you know, when I went on Clubhouse the first time, my friends Sriram and Arti had invited me and Fiji, and we joined, and I was cool. I was like, it was done on like 1 hour's notice, and I was in sweatpants and I was just in my house hanging out and I could just have this cool thing. And it was very low pressure relative to if I had been doing a video cast to the exact same audience. It just felt lower pressure. It just felt easier. And there's something to that. VR is great for this. You know, you don't have to put your headset, you know, you put your headset on, you don't have to be wearing any clothes. I mean, I recommend it honestly as a personal level, but like you don't have to be wearing any clothes and you can be in VR and be in an audience and have expressiveness greater than audio, but also still not have that pressure that you feel to observe yourself, or that you feel to have curate your face to your environment. There's a second thing too, where I think actually FRL, the work that we do in Facebook Reality Labs, was one of the catalysts for the company, is spatial audio. We've done these demonstrations from our research labs, now all the way integrating into products, on the importance of spatialized audio. The fact that we're on this podcast, and when you guys speak, it sounds like your voices are coming from between my two ears, because I have headphones on. That is very weird. No sound in the universe comes from that place, and my body knows it. And it's what prevents us from having sidebars or different conversations at once, which we do so seamlessly when we're all in a room together, but is so hard on VC. It's because all of our voices are literally occupying the same space. And whereas when you spatialize audio, Lauren, if your voice was over to my right, and Michael, if your voice was off to my left, it would actually allow me to hear you both and actually hear you both speak at the same time and internalize that and manage it. And it feels much more natural. So I think, yeah, you know, I think audio is something interesting and it's worth exploring. I especially love spatialized audio. And it can be artificially spatialized. It doesn't matter where people really are. It just matters that they have a place. So I'm excited to explore that space further.
I'm glad you brought up taking time off because I just had last week off and I had the opportunity to just be off of my phone for periods of time, which is great. This is part of my new goal. Like I'm going to live offline more. And I didn't go on Clubhouse once. And I had been experimenting with Clubhouse prior to that. I'd done a couple little shows and really liked tuning in. But I found that when I was just away from screens and had a moment to breathe, the last thing I wanted to do was try to connect to audio streams. And it's very anecdotal, but I'm wondering if you see this like sort of moment for audio being something that is partly a product of the pandemic, of us staying in place. And what happens when we start to move about a little bit more freely again?
Yeah, I mean, I think what I expect to happen as the pandemic winds down is people will return, from the total isolation that many of us have experienced over the last year. But I don't think we'll go all the way back. There are things that we will take with us, some out of habit, but some out of, you know, great intention. I believe in the future of remote work. I think this is a great way to do a podcast. I think if we had waited to schedule it until we were all in the same place, it had taken longer. You'd have gotten, you know, it'd have been more formal. It'd have been a lot of weird things. I like this. There's a lot of things that I don't like as well in terms of losing touch with key people that I wanted to have a relationship with just because we haven't seen each other and we don't have a pretext for a meeting. There are things that I'm going to miss. And so I think we're going to come back to a place that's somewhere in between. And then over the fullness of time, I expect remote work to play a bigger role. I expect people in more geographic diverse places to be working together to be a more normal thing. You're going to get better access to a global talent pool. Global talent's going to have better access to jobs. There's a lot of good things there. So I think we are headed down a very healthy path, actually. And thankfully, after the pandemic ends, it won't be so forced. We will actually have the time to grow and mature into it. We as humans contain multitudes. That's not my words, obviously, but I do believe in that. We can contradict ourselves. We can at times want to be more connected, and we can at the same person, maybe even at the same time, want to feel less connected. And those things, as we go about our lives, I will spend time here working. I love my job. I wake up looking forward to doing my job. At the end of the day, I still am tired and I want to go away from my job and spend time with my kids and my family and make dinner and not be connected. And then later on, I'll be like, but I kind of want to be connected again. I wonder what's happening. I'm in control of that. And it's not inconsistent. It's not a problem. It's not like just because one moment I wanted to put my phone down and not connect, suddenly all of social media must, it's like, come on now. Let's not take things to these extremes. I don't always play basketball. Sometimes I want to do something different. Sometimes I do. These are fine. Like, these are fine. Everything doesn't have to be to infinity or to zero. Things can live in the middle. In fact, everything lives in the middle.
By the way, I did not realize you play basketball. So the next time awful. We do this, we're going to... That's great. We are going to do something called Hoops for Scoops. And every time I beat you at basketball, you have to tell me something secret going on in Facebook.
No, we will just skip the basketball. I actually don't ever play basketball because I'm awful at it. We can skip the basketball. You can just ask me questions for an hour, which, by the way, I've already agreed to. So you don't actually have to play basketball at all for this.
You have to pull back. You really have to pull back the curtain and tell me all this stuff, whole product roadmap.
Yeah, well, my comms team is now on because there's no chance they're going to let me do that because I am awful at basketball. Truly atrocious. Reasonable defender, reasonable rebounder, but I just have, I've got no handles. I've got no jump shot.
All right, Boz, here's one final question. When are you going to start a Substack?
Can I tell you one of the funniest stories about this? Is I have a Substack, which I've sent zero emails to, but I have, I think, 1,000 subscribers. And I think I've decided that's really the key for me, is never sending an email is a great way to accumulate subscribers. And I think zero of them are angry at me. Zero of those people are disappointed with my work. So I created one just to test it out and understand what was going on over there. And I haven't sent anything out. I do have a blog, boz.com. I really should at least start emailing out blog articles when I put them on the website.
And so, I mean, isn't Facebook also launching a newsletter product? Like, what's going to happen when Facebook has its own newsletter product and you're monetizing your, I don't know, basketball hobby from Substack?
Oh my goodness. Yeah, listen, people, I pay other people for basketball. They don't pay me for it. That's the way that sequence, that's the way that works. Let me tell you how that economy works. No, look, I just think it makes so much sense. And the inclination of many, especially I think in the press, to frame all these things as zero sum kind of bums me out. It's like, yeah, we should have lots of competing models. We should have different models that have different take rates in exchange for different value exchanges. That is competition. That's the market that you're supposed to want. It's not the market of one person doing it. In the same way that people don't just use Facebook. They use Facebook, they use Twitter, they use Snapchat, they use TikTok. They use them all. And they all take on their own life and they have their own content creation and their own, you know, social values and mores. It's a good and healthy and very natural thing for us to have lots of different types of things where subtle differences could make a big difference in outcomes for people. So I'm always glad to see more people diving into spaces that I think are growing. You know, I'm sympathetic to the changes that the media industry has been going through ever since the advent of the internet, ever since Craigslist, really. And I don't have an answer to that. And I don't have an answer for where it's going. But I do believe that if people go out and manage to create consumer value, where consumers are willing to exchange money and or time for goods and services, that will continue to sustain us as a society. So I'm glad to see people out there experimenting. Obviously, I'm a huge fan of Wired. It's an institution and one that has been influential on me since I was in middle school. At the same time, I'm also thrilled for people like Casey Newton going out and forging their own path and trying their own thing. And I hope we find a space to have both of those things in the future.
Well, thank you for creating some consumer value on our show.
Well, that remains to be seen, but of course you're welcome. It's been a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Okay. While we have you, and before we let you go, we would like you to give our listeners a recommendation. I know you listen to the show and I know you're a big fan. And, this is the section of the show where we ask our guests to recommend a thing that they have watched or read or listened to or consumed in some way that they would like to tell other people about.
It's tempting to use this space to talk more about Portal, but as I've done that many times over the course of the show already, I'm gonna mix it up. I've been cooking a ton during the pandemic, and I love cooking, and I kind of lost touch with it when I was commuting more, but it's what I've been able to pick up as cooking for the whole family. And I am hyped on these pots and pans that my wife found through a Facebook ad, true story, called Hexaclad. Little known fact about me, I used to sell cutlery. It was my internship in college. I sold Cutco knives. They are the best knives. They have this innovation, the double D serrate. It's a whole thing. I could sell you a set of knives later. But they had a very similar innovation. Hexaclad solves the age-old problem of how do you take a nonstick surface, which is great to clean, but unfortunately is easily scratched, and an all-clad, iron-clad pan, which is robust to any kind of tool use, but unfortunately is hard to clean. And they've got a pattern of steel, and then inset with that is a nonstick surface. So any part of the steel at any given time is very small, and so it's very easy to clean. But the steel is there, so if you're using a tool, a spatula, it's hitting the steel, not the nonstick. And they cook really well, nice even heat across a wide range of burners and flames. They work on the inductive, which is amazing. I also have gas. And they're a dream to clean. So I'm going to put the strong recommendation out, not sponsored, not an ad, for Hexaclad.
Except now that you have spoken this out loud, we are going to start seeing ads for this in our feeds.
Listen, that's just a coincidence. They were already there. You'll just notice them now.
Okay.
All right. Thanks for the recommendation.
It's a good one.
It sounds good.
All right.
Thank you so much for the time. Wow. I did not anticipate we would take up your full hour, but we did. And thank you.
I'm a talker.
A really, really wide-ranging and insightful conversation. Really enjoyed it.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks so much, Boz. All right. Well, I'm glad we got a recommendation out of Boz. We should probably do our own since our listeners really like these. Mike, what's your recommendation this week?
I am going to recommend a podcast. It is the season 2 of one of my favorite podcasts just dropped. It's called Cocaine and Rhinestones. Okay. It is a history of country music, and it is unlike any other history podcast that you've ever listened to. I've talked about this before. The first season is really just incredible, and it's all done by one person who researches it, writes it, records it, and edits it himself and self-publishes it. So it's not done in a podcast network. His name is Tyler Mahan Coe. He's the son of outlaw country star David Allen Coe. Tyler did the whole first season, put it out back in like 2017. Everybody absolutely loved it. It's got millions of listens, but season one ended in January of 2018. So it's been a long wait for season two. The wait is worth it. Season two just dropped this week. And the entire season is about the career of George Jones. So he's like a huge country star. And he had a very long recording career. So by talking about the different parts of his career, Tyler can sort of bring you through basically the history of country music through the entire second half of the 20th century. Anyway, the first episode is a doozy. It's over 2 hours long, and it starts with about 15 minutes on the history of pinball. So highly recommended, Cocaine and Rhinestones, season two.
Wow. This podcast does everything. Rhinestones, cocaine, pinball, country music, George Jones.
Well, there was very little cocaine in season one, but if you know anything about George Jones, he's a very sad story of addiction in his life. So there's likely to be a lot more talk about that particular subject in season two.
All right. And remind us of the name of the podcast once more.
It's called Cocaine and Rhinestones. You can find it at cocaineandrhinestones.com or wherever you listen to this thing.
I just really wanted to hear you say that again. That juxtaposition, it's pretty great.
Well, that's country music for you. It's all about those juxtapositions. What is your recommendation, Lauren Good?
My recommendation this week is Nomadland. It's a movie based on a 2017 nonfiction book of the same name. It's a really beautifully done and somewhat sad film about a precarious workforce, an aging population whose permanent or stable jobs have dried up in the wake of the 2008 economic collapse. And these people decide to live in vans or RVs and move around looking for seasonal work. I just watched it the other night. One of the reviews I read about it afterwards said that there's a lot of grief in the film, but that it doesn't wallow. And I think that that's an accurate description of it. It's very much about resilience, but at the same time, as you're watching it, you can't ignore the systemic problems or macroeconomic issues that have put people in these positions to begin with. The main character, named Fern, who is played by Frances McDormand, has these plates in her van that have sort of emotional meaning to her. And at one point, they end up getting broken. And she kind of painstakingly puts them back together. And I saw it really as kind of like a metaphor for the entire story and reminded me of Kintsukuroi, which is this sort of Japanese method of like rebuilding pottery, right? But like rebuilding it with gold or other materials to make it actually stronger than before it was broken. it's, like I said, just kind of this small thing, but this really kind of touching scene in the film. And then, and, I mean, another part of the film, too, is that there are people woven into the narrative who reach out to Fern and try to help her or try to offer her sort of a more permanent living situation. She just kind of drives away from that because at this point she's just, this is her life now. And anyway, I'm probably getting a little too into the description here. You should just go watch it yourself. But I recommend Nomadland. It's on Hulu. If you're a Hulu subscriber, that's where you can find it.
You can't see this because it's audio, but I'm doing the Leo DiCaprio pointing the TV meme. Because I loved this movie. I thought it was really good. I think everybody should see it, especially if they shop at Amazon. Also, you know, you're right. It is a movie filled with a lot of sadness and grief. But, you know, true art is never depressing.
I think that's a beautiful way to look at it, Mike. All right. That is our show for this week. Thanks to Andrew Bosworth from Facebook for joining us and for answering our many questions. And thanks to all of you for listening. If you have feedback, you can find all of us on Twitter. We're always on Twitter. Just check the show notes. We'll put our handles there. This show is produced by the excellent Boone Ashworth. And I should also note that two of our biggest advocates on this podcast have been Scott Rosenfield and Megan Greenwell, site director of Wired.com and the editor of Wired.com. And both of them are leaving Wired, so we wanted to give them a big send-off and a giant thank you for all of their work on this show. So thanks, Scott and Megan. We'll be back next week.
Want a new podcast to look forward to each week? One that's entertaining, informative, and packed with actionable content? Come on, of course you do. Introducing The Jordan Harbinger Show. The Jordan Harbinger Show, which Apple named one of its best of 2018, is aimed at making you a better informed, more critical thinker so you can get a sense of how the world actually works and come to your own conclusions about what's happening, even inside your own brain. Jordan dives into the minds of fascinating people, from athletes, authors, and scientists to mobsters, spies, and hostage negotiators. Search for The Jordan Harbinger Show. That's H-A-R, B as in boy, I, N as in Nancy, G-E-R, in Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you're listening right now.